Hey, welcome to another Crypto Study Hall. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Kate.
And today we have Craig Salm on from Grayscale. Thanks so much for hanging out with us this Friday.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Yeah.
So we would love to hear about how you got into kind of the crypto world.
Yeah. So I first discovered Bitcoin back when I was in law school. So that was around 2011, 2012. Before you think to yourselves, wow, that was really early. You probably bought a lot of Bitcoin. I did not because, you know, I was in law school, had student loans to pay off. So it was really more of an intellectual investment. I read a lot of like tech journals and Wired magazine and learned about Silk Road and this thing called Bitcoin that was really the thing powering it because it's what a lot of people were using to buy different goods and services, both legal and illegal on that marketplace. And so I was just super fascinated by it as like a new technology and a new way that people were interacting with the internet and started just to educate myself on the side by learning about like how it's being used. I took a couple of computer science courses actually because I really wanted to get a very deep fundamental of it and learn about how a blockchain works and how networking works and the node operators and the miners, how all that came together to produce this thing called Bitcoin. And so that was in law school. Law school is unique because if you do really well your first year and you want to go to one of these big law firms in, you know, New York or California or any of those locations, then you kind of get the offer after your first year, depending solely on your grades. And then you do this summer associate position where you go to work at a firm. And then after your third year, the assumption is that you'll go to work at that law firm. And so I got an offer at a firm called Paul Weiss, which was, you know, very great law firm, both litigation and corporate practices. And it was a great opportunity for me because it offered the ability to really keep my options open in terms of what type of law I wanted to practice, all the while thinking, well, this thing Bitcoin is really cool and exciting, but if I'm going to be valuable and I really want to go to work in this industry, then I should first learn how to be a good lawyer, you know, learn about working with clients, learn about drafting contracts, learn about researching rules, learn about disclosures and all those things. And so I went to Paul Weiss, that was 2013, and really kept wanted to be just an open book in terms of learning about M&A and finance and securities and investment management, really, again, to just get as broad a base of knowledge as possible. While continuing on the side to stay up to speed on what was going on with Bitcoin and the term decentralized ledger technology was also how people were describing blockchains back then. And then after my second year, I got the opportunity to go work in-house at Apollo Global Management, which was one of our largest clients. They did a program called the secondment where they bring in one of the lawyers at Paul Weiss to work in-house. And it's mutually beneficial because from Apollo's perspective, they're getting a lawyer that's full-time dedicated to their matters. And from Paul Weiss's perspective, they're sending somebody on the inside of the client to learn about how they, you know, think and work. And then the idea is that you come back to Paul Weiss and you can share that knowledge and just be a much better counsel to them. And so I jumped at the opportunity and loved it because, you know, rather than working at a law firm where you're focused a lot on single matters and can kind of be a silo at some points, going in-house, I was able to work with not just the in-house lawyers, but their compliance people, ops, the traders, sales, marketing, seeing the whole full picture. And that's when I realized that long-term, I did not want to stay at a law firm, but instead wanted to go in-house. And so I was at Apollo for about 10 months. And right when I got back, I started putting together a list of every Bitcoin, crypto, decentralized ledger technology, blockchain company in the New York area, and just started sending out cold emails, trying to set up meetings and just figure out where I wanted to land. And I got pretty lucky because it turned out that somebody I had met who worked at Digital Currency Group at the time, a gentleman named Travis Scher, somebody I'd met, and I said, hey, I had no idea that you worked in crypto. Would love to just buy you a cup of coffee and tell you what I'm trying to do, and then just go from there. And so that meeting happened, and he put me in touch with a couple of different companies, one of which ended up being Grayscale. And Grayscale was really the perfect marriage of my both intellectual curiosity in crypto with the professional experience I'd gained at Paul Weiss. Because what Grayscale is a asset management firm that, you know, just like other asset management firms, whether it's iShares or Vanguard or WisdomTree, really is just that financial institution, except instead of managing, you know, traditional stocks, bonds, currencies, or what have you, they manage cryptocurrencies. And so I went in. It's the longer story there, but we don't have a lot of time. I wanted to talk more about the crypto and ETF stuff with you all. But over the course of basically a year of interacting with Michael Sonnenschein, our current CEO, eventually got the job, became the first lawyer. And the knowledge and experience I gained within Paul Weiss and Apollo of capital markets, investment management, was really invaluable, the type of work that I do at Grayscale today. So that was January 2018, first lawyer there. Now we have a legal team that is about five people of both attorneys and paralegals. So it's been quite the journey.
Wow. So, I mean, firstly, I wonder how you felt, you know, looking back at the price of Bitcoin back in your like law school days and just like seeing the price it is now. I oftentimes think about the person who bought the pizza in Bitcoin, the legendary crypto story, the like multi-million dollar pizza. But so on this podcast, we talk a ton about future-proofing your career. Like, how can we sort of like take steps to ensure that we're not going to be automated out, that we can sort of like embrace the now, embrace the future, and, you know, be flexible enough to kind of like ride, you know, the technology waves as they come and go. I'm sure I can't even imagine like what our careers will look like in 20, 30 years. But I was keen to see that on Grayscale's website, you guys talk about future-proofing your investments. Do you want to just talk for a minute about how you understand that as a concept? Where does cryptocurrency fit into folks' investment strategies and making them set up for the long term?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things there. Not to turn this into like a career advice episode.
We love it. We'll take it. I mean, everyone needs free advice.
Yeah. I mean, I often get asked questions like, from law students and people at law firms trying to break into crypto, things such as, you know, how do I get into crypto law or how do I become a crypto lawyer? And my response to that is those two things don't exist. There's no crypto law. There's no crypto lawyer. What you really should be doing is figuring out what capacity you want to work within the cryptocurrency industry, and then learn the law, the rules, the regulations that apply to that area, and then gain that skill set, and then go, you know, break in there, work at a company, and do that. And so for me, I knew that I wanted to work at a financial institution within crypto. And so learning about securities laws, learning about different, you know, rules to offer securities to different types of investors, learning how to draft disclosure documents like PPMs, learning how to draft reports like 10Ks, 10Qs, was really how I would become valuable to Grayscale ultimately. Similarly, if you want to get into something like NFTs, then, you know, learn about intellectual property law. If you want to get into, those are just two good examples. If you want to do the tax side of things, because that's becoming a big question for miners and stakers and how they report their different gains and things like that. So first figure out like what aspect of the law do you want to be in, and then you can apply that to a different cryptocurrency company. And that's a way that you can, you know, future-proof your career and be valuable to a lot of these different startups and businesses within the cryptocurrency industry. In terms of future-proofing your investments, Grayscale is a firm, Digital Currency Group, our parent company as well, really believes that cryptocurrency is here to stay. And it has a place within every investor's portfolio, whether that's, 100 basis points, 500 or more than that, really depends on what your risk appetite and your goals are. And the interesting thing that I think we're seeing around cryptocurrency today is we're finding it's not just one unitary thing. There's different sectors even within crypto. So you have more of digital gold type assets, financial assets like Bitcoin. Then you have smart contract platforms, which allow for different types of use cases on top of just the simple sending, holding, and receiving value that Bitcoin offers. So that's protocols like Ethereum or Solana. Then taking, you know, the third step is decentralized finance. And so that's layering on top of smart contracts, things like exchanging, lending, borrowing, insurance. So we're seeing multiple different iterations in different sectors. And I think it's interesting to see how investors are viewing that as well, because whereas you might originally a couple of years ago had, you know, one percentage of your portfolio that you allocate to crypto, now we're seeing that being divvied up even further into different sectors within crypto, whether it's currencies, smart contracts, DeFi, entertainment and gaming, like what we're seeing with, you know, metaverse and NFTs and things like that.
Super interesting. So I'm like biased to being a huge like ETF fan, right? I'm like in the capital markets and equities markets, a huge ETF investor, because in a way I call it kind of like lazy river investing. Like I don't have to do the individual research. I let someone else do it instead. So I imagine myself on like one of those inner tubes at a hotel, like just floating around and letting someone else do the hard work of figuring it out. And sometimes being lazy as an investor is great. You just let someone else do the research, and ETFs have done pretty well. In the crypto industry, we're still kind of waiting, you know, for the SEC to make some approvals on like spot ETFs, right? Like for the crypto market, spot cash ETFs for crypto. But what is Grayscale doing in this space? And I know you've talked about kind of the life cycle of ETFs. Maybe you can just educate us a bit on the process for a crypto ETF.
Yeah. So, you know, the ETF wrapper is really the optimal way to gain exposure to most assets. If you're looking to invest in the asset through a security that has reporting, audited financial statements, tax information statements, things like that, having it sit in your portfolio alongside all the other things that you hold in your brokerage account. But as you noted today, an ETF for, you know, Bitcoin, let alone any other cryptocurrency, has not been approved by the regulator that would approve that type of product, the SEC. And so Grayscale has really approached our business in terms of enabling access and exposure to the digital currency asset class through product structures that we believe to be the next best thing in the absence of an ETF. And so we've designed this four-stage product lifecycle, where each stage of the lifecycle results in a product becoming more accessible and more available to investors. So the first stage is all of our products start off as a private placement under Rule 506C of Reg D. And so that's an exemption from registering with the SEC under the 33 Act. And what it results in is the shares can only initially be offered to accredited investors. So those are investors of a certain level of net income or net worth. And those investors are subject to at least a one-year holding period initially. So it's as restrictive as the offering can be. And the reason why, the policy reason for that is because the SEC obviously has important investor protection concerns. And whereas something like an ETF would result in these assets being available to retail investors with no restrictions, they're not so okay with that as much as they are an accredited investor who is bearing the risk of the investment for at least a year, because the assumption is that that type of investor can fend for themselves, you know, protect themselves because of their sophistication and net worth. Whether you agree with that policy is neither here nor there, but it is the state of the law. So that's the first stage, private placement, Rule 506C, only accredited investors, one-year holding period. The second stage is something that is quite unique in that knowing that the shares created in the private placement after 1 year could be freely tradable, meaning they could be sold to not just accredited investors, but also retail investors, and also without a holding period. We did something under a rule called 15C211, which is what allows broker dealers to trade and quote securities on a public market. And so today, for instance, our Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, which originally launched in 2013, in 2015, we obtained a public quotation on the over-the-counter markets. And so that's how most folks come to know about Grayscale, through the ticker symbol GBTC, which is what Grayscale Bitcoin Trust trades under. And on that marketplace, OTCQX, the shares report under something called the Alternative Reporting Standards, which is similar to SEC reporting standards, but it's not actually reported to the SEC. But there are things like annual reports and quarterly reports and press releases, which are analogous to 10Ks, 10Qs, and 8Ks. So that's the second stage, and those shares are available to all types of retail investors. The third stage is we seek to make our products SEC reporting. And so what that does is register the shares under the 34 Act. and results in that original holding period in the private placement being reduced from 1 year to 6 months. It also just makes the product more transparent for investors because it becomes SEC reporting and now does have to file 10Ks, 10Qs, 8Ks, and so on. And so again, this model is really intended to make the product more accessible, more available to investors, more transparent. I think in this third stage, for a lot of more institutional and regulated investors, it's really important to them because their risk, compliance, legal, and other advisors really want any investment to at least be SEC reporting. So that's the third stage. And then the fourth and final stage, which is what we consider to be the holy grail, is converting the product into an ETF. And so what that would do is uplist the product to a national securities exchange, like NYSE Arca, and also result in something called the arbitrage mechanism being enabled, which would result in the shares being able to better track NAV. Because importantly, the shares that trade on the public markets on OTCQX can trade at premiums and discounts because we don't have this arbitrage mechanism in place that is inherent to the ETF model.
In the equities markets, you need a lot of liquidity, right, to continually like rebalance the positions. Do you feel like there's that level of liquidity in crypto right now, or is there still room for more? Like, I read the headlines about like Virtu and others doing market making. Is that kind of like the precursor to have the, you know, how do you rebalance a crypto ETF? And this is a really basic question, but I don't know. Yeah. Is the tech, no. Are we there yet as far as like the liquidity?
So one of the most important distinctions between Grayscale's efforts to convert GBDC into an ETF versus other applicants that are out there, which are all great firms. But the important distinction is that we have an actual publicly traded product today that's the largest Bitcoin fund in the world. It holds about 3.4% of all Bitcoin outstanding. Wow. It's about $30 billion of AUM. It has about 150,000 investors and is trading hundreds of millions of dollars in daily volume. And so we're regularly comparing this product to other commodity-based ETFs, and it's ranking, you know, just behind GLD and IAU, the world's first and second largest gold ETFs.
That's crazy. So, I mean, that's wild.
Yeah. And so, and one of the arguments we often make is, you know, this product is already out there. It clearly shows that it can trade. You know, we're seeking to make it even more regulated and thus increase investor protections by converting it to an ETF and further bring it within the regulatory perimeter, because we think that's really important for investor protection and it's what our investors really want and deserve.
Yeah. Right. So on the formation of an ETF, I think the accredited investor piece garners a significant amount of controversy, especially from my former boss, Mike Pivovar, has been like an outspoken opposition to accredited investor rules. And a lot of the thinking there is that A, the threshold of your, you know, yearly income has no ability to determine whether or not, like, what your risk tolerance is. And then the second piece is that it excludes people below that threshold from having the ability to those, like, high gains being realized from some of these, like, riskier investments. But it becomes a point where I'm curious, like, what is too much risk? And I'm thinking about this in terms of the Department of Labor has recently come out strongly advising against any sort of 401k that involves cryptocurrencies and basically just saying, like, crypto should not be a part of your retirement plan. I would love to hear what Grayscale and your thoughts are on this statement and just sort of like, what is your thinking on, you know, DOL's statement and, you know, where they're coming from with this.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think the theme that you're highlighting is one that I often think about. And at least in terms of securities regulation in the US, my view is that it should really all be about disclosure. If you're properly disclosing all of the risks and the investor is fully aware of it, then no regulator should be making a merit-based determination on what a given individual should or should not be investing in. And the SEC is a disclosure regulator. And, you know, in the context of our efforts to seek to convert GBDC into an ETF, as well as making it an SEC reporting company a couple of years ago, we had a really positive engagement with the various SEC staffers that were reviewing our filing and disclosures on making our disclosures more robust and enhanced so that investors could better understand Bitcoin, how it's trading, how we price it, how we custody it. And, you know, I think our disclosures that we have are really the best in class for this type of product. And at the end of the day, that really is what it's about. It's about disclosure to the investor so that they're fully informed about what they're getting into. And then, you know, in terms of the what you mentioned about the accredited investor rules, crypto itself is very interesting because you have, you know, some of the smartest thinkers in the space, some of the software engineers writing the code, working on these protocols are not even 20 years old. And, you know, they don't have an income necessarily, certainly not of the level that the accredited investor rules allow. Even if their net worth is exceeding that, it's probably in crypto. And I don't know that those assets are being included in what a lot of different firms are using to determine their accredited investor status. So I think it is worth thinking about whether the level of knowledge is something we should put more credence in as opposed to just net income and net worth. I think those are easy tests because it's a objective number that you can look at, but it's worth thinking about other ways that we can determine whether or not people should or should not be making these types of investments.
And we also, you know, we often talk about social justice on this podcast, right? And minimum accredited investor, I think, irks some people because like the people who've amassed this level of wealth or have that salary often tend to be white men. And it's not throwing shade on the rules, but like it is in effect, you could look at it from the perspective of, is this rule excluding more women and minorities from participating in the early stage of innovative growth? Yes, there's more risk, but there's more upside. And by having these standards, are you inadvertently discriminating against diversity and gender, you know, wealth creation? So that's just throwing that out there. I know it might sound controversial, but when I look at, you know, we often look at, well, who's getting the VC funding? Women only get like, and minorities get 2% of that VC funding, but then women and minorities might also be detrimentally like shut out of the innovation economy because they can't be minimum accredited investors. So I know it's like a bigger issue, but it's worth pointing out. And with respect to your question, Kate, about like rules on like, should 401ks be invested in crypto or not? My thinking on that is they already are, even though they don't realize it. Like the S&P is already 5% of it is correlated to crypto, right? There already is a connection. That's already, that horse has left the stable, right? We are already, 401k is already in crypto, even if they don't think they are. So it's more about like, how do you create, you know, that regulatory framework that there are the disclosures, you know, and the stability through like clear regulation, because we're already in it. We can't shut it back into some box. Like we're already, everyone is invested in crypto if you're invested in the markets indirectly at this point, is my thesis.
And, one of the added benefits of allowing GBTC to convert to an ETF is that it would enable more 401ks to invest in the product. You know, this is our number one priority right now. And I think it's very important to our existing investors. And in other ways, it's even broader than that, because if you look at something like the White House executive order from last week, that was a really positive indication from the highest executive of America saying we want to be leaders in crypto and Web3. The ways we can do that are, on the one hand, of course, protecting investors and consumers, but also figuring out how we can allow this innovation to flourish. And I would say that one way you can do that is by bring Bitcoin and crypto further within the regulatory perimeter by approving products like GBTC and other spot-based ETFs to become ETFs. And, you know, we, back in October, refiled our application to convert GBTC into an ETF. And that kicked off a process where we're now engaged with the SEC in an open comment letter period because they want to, you know, hear from the public, make sure they're taking all the information in to make sure that they're fully considering this thoughtfully. And we actually started a campaign with a website, grayscale.com/comment, get a little plug in there. And right. So far, we've seen over 2,600 letters that have been submitted to the SEC.
Get out of here.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a record, but I don't know that there's been a campaign like this. Yeah.
We
go through the letters. There's a couple of common themes that we're seeing throughout them. One is that, you know, in the name of investor protection, we should have spot-based Bitcoin ETFs in the U.S. to, you know, bring Bitcoin within the regulatory perimeter. Another one is this America competitiveness and leadership that we saw expressed in this White House executive order. And then the other theme, which we haven't really got into, is that the SEC did make a very positive step forward last summer in approving not a spot-based Bitcoin ETF that holds physical Bitcoin or quote physical, but a futures-based Bitcoin ETF that holds a derivative. And, you know, that's great for more access and exposure to Bitcoin. But now we believe that if you're comfortable with that type of product, then you should also be comfortable with the ones that hold physical or spot Bitcoin, because both products are based on the underlying Bitcoin markets.
Well, we'll be sure to provide a link to that resource so that, you know, maybe we can get you guys a few more letters to the SEC.
Of course. And if you can count two more from you two, that would be great.
100%. Yeah. Signed by Crypto Study Hall's.
That would actually be awesome.
We actually have a barcode on our, we have these stickers where if you scan them, it sends you to an email with a little template that you can fill in for why you think the SEC.
Oh my God. I want a QR code for Crypto Study Hall now. That's awesome. I'm going to copy that.
You guys really are a digitally first company.
You really are. My mind is blown right now.
But no, seriously, Craig, this has been incredibly insightful and just like wonderful to hear your perspective. I know we're closing out on time here, but it's been a pleasure to have you on. Really looking forward to see what Grayscale continues to do in the future. And, you know, we'll be waiting eagerly to see what the SEC does in regards to spot ETFs.
All right. Kate and Kirsten, it's been great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. That was good.